As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Standard Room Only podcast. Yes, I'm your host, Ben Standick. I cover the Washington Commanders for The Athletic. I have returned from the Senior Bowl to get back in the swing of things here in the DMV. We'll, of course, talk a lot about what went down at the Senior Bowl on this episode. Somewhat, of course, about the players and what it means for Washington, but a lot of behind-the-scene details. What's the purpose of the Senior Bowl? Where things are changing? Things that are that could impact not just the Senior Bowl, but the pre-draft setup overall going forward. To do that, my colleague Nikki Javala with the Washington Post, who was down there in Mobile with me. So we'll get to all that in a moment. If you have not already, make sure you're subscribing, though, to this episode. Well, let me rephrase that. Subscribe to this podcast. Obviously, download the episode, but subscribe and you'll get all the episodes coming to your podcatcher, whatever you guys and gals are using out there. Also, make sure to subscribe to The Athletic. Stories up, draft-related and team-building-related, offensive coordinator search, all these, you know, what's the quarterback deal going to be, all that discussed here on this episode, and of course written about in The Athletic on Monday. I'll have like a notebook kind of getting everybody kind of up to speed on what I've, you know, where things stand on the OC search, players that stood out to me, and scouts around the league down at the combine and so on. So make sure to subscribe and check all of that out. I did want to make a mention here about the passing of former Washington general manager Bobby Bethard. Happened last week. Condolences to his family. I wanted to talk about, for those who were maybe, you know, a bit young to have been around for the Bethard era and what it meant, and also to a degree what it could mean now for where the Washington Commanders are at. First of all, Bethard, it was Joe Gibbs as head coach and Jack Kent Cook as the owner, who were the triumvirate for the era that led to 3 Super Bowl championships and 4 Super Bowl appearances. As we know, Washington won 3 Super Bowls with 3 different quarterbacks, which is an unbelievable anomaly in this era. And needless to say, Joe Gibbs gets tons of credit for that success that happened there. But, you know, Bobby Bethard was the architect in so many ways, and he had a mad scientist approach to him. When we talk about these different quarterbacks, right? Well, think of it like this. It's not just that era. It's not just Joe Theismann, who was here initially before Gibbs arrived. Not just Doug Williams, who had had some success in Tampa, then was kind of thrown on the scrap heap and brought back here. Or not brought back here, but brought to Washington. He and Gibbs had worked together before. And not even just Mark Rypien, who was a 6th-round pick who went on to become Super Bowl MVP, which in and of itself is incredibly rare, as we know. But Bethard also drafted Jay Schrader in the 3rd round, when Jay Schrader at that point was a failed minor league baseball player and who had played quarterback for UCLA. But I don't know what the Mel Kuypers of the world were saying then. A 3rd-round pick seemed aggressive for what Jay Schrader's circumstances were, and yet he had a big arm and eventually played quarterback for a Redskins team that reached the NFC Championship game, losing to the Giants. Not only did Rippon get picked in the sixth round and win a Super Bowl, Stan Humphries was picked in the sixth round a couple years later, and when Beathard went to the Chargers, Humphries was the quarterback that won an AFC Championship for that team. They found Joe Jacoby, who was an undrafted defensive lineman, turned him into one of the best tackles ever in league history. Beathard drafted a linebacker in Monty Coleman in the 11th round out of Central Arkansas. And Coleman went on to play 15 years, retire as the player with the most games played in franchise history. And then, of course, you have the first round picks when Beathard famously would trade away first rounders all the time. In his years, he only drafted three players in the first round. Two of them went to the Hall of Fame, Art Monk, and then, of course, Darryl Green. Darryl Green, hardly a conventional pick in that he was playing for a Division II program in Texas that, you know, certainly not a main, you know, on the main path there. But this is what Bobby Beathard did. He searched high and he searched low, and he didn't just stay to conventional norms. And it played a huge role in not just obviously Washington having success. He helped the Chargers get to a Super Bowl, and he was part of the Dolphins team that went on to have an undefeated season, etc. So Beathard did a lot of interesting things, and he just did it. If I say he did it to the beat of his own drummer, I don't mean that he was just wacky for the sake of wacky, but he did what he thought he needed to do and didn't worry so much about perception. Of course, this is not the social media era or things along those lines, but nonetheless, they still keep track of what you do in the standings. And I say all this to mention in the context of the current team is that too often, whether you're talking about the Commanders or really any sports team, when teams go outside the norm, they go out, you know, they color outside the lines of what is perceived to be something that somebody should do, they get criticized. Doesn't even matter necessarily who the individual was that they picked or what the end result was of the move in the moment. You don't know end result of anything until a player's career is retired or way down the road. But I think it's important because you look at a lot of the situations lately for Washington, and conventional thinking does not automatically work, right? Washington, everybody says, don't never, ever, ever draft a guard in the first round, let alone top 10 pick. And there's value to that. That's not a position where you want to invest that type of assets into. And yet, Brandon Scherff, it's hard to argue that wasn't a good pick for Washington. When they took him fifth overall, yes, they were taking him to be a tackle, and they figured that was wrong days into the offseason program. But Brandon Scherff went on to be one of the better linemen in franchise history, a multi-time Pro Bowler, an all-pro, you know, first one they had here, in over a decade. All these things, well over a decade, all these things are good, and sure, to this day, people will say, well, they shouldn't have drafted Brandon Scherff. And maybe to an extent that's fair, but the point is, drafting any player in the first round who becomes a Pro Bowler or a viable starter for years, that's a good thing, and they did that, okay? There's a similar debate going on right now at defensive tackle. Everybody says conventionally, don't sign two defensive tackles to huge money. Washington, of course, already paid John Allen. Now the question is, what will they do with Daron Payne, who is a free agent this year? We've talked a lot about that. Don't expect Daron Payne to take a home down discount. And Washington already was making moves, clearly, with the idea of replacing him when they draft Fedarian Mathis in the second round last year. But now Payne goes on to have a tremendous year, makes the Pro Bowl. What do? If you follow conventional thinking, he's out the door. But if you look at it and say, well, we have a guy with John Allen who forms, you know, one of, if not the best, defensive tackle tandem in the league, and that's where this team can really make, make some hay, maybe that's something to consider. But if you just go off of conventional thinking, you won't get there. Same thing with, like, the tight end position. I went through this the other day, and Nikki and I talked about this a little bit. Of course, nobody's going to say draft a tight end in the first round. And, yeah, I would agree that Washington doesn't really need more playmakers. They need more other things, offensive line, cornerback, what have you. But if they determine that a tight end is the best thing to have there, when they're picking at 16 or maybe in round two, and they see this player as somebody who can help them in, as a two-way threat, receiver, blocker, etc., don't boo the pick if they make it. Obviously, hopefully the player wins out and does a good job. But I always look at what's the logic of something. Can I understand why a move was made? If you can do that, almost regardless of what happens from there, I can probably say, you know what? Not everything works, but I understood why they did it. And that's what makes looking back at the Bobby Bethard era so interesting. We were a much less sophisticated audience back then. And it was like, what is happening here? Why is he, trade? There was no Jimmy Johnson trade chart that everybody kind of uses now. It just falls into a pattern with that. Bethard was out there. I'm sure people would have criticized, choosing Darryl Green. Even like the Art Monk pick, I don't think was like automatically viewed as a great one. But where they picked him in sort of the middle of the first round, Monk was like a running back more in college than anything else, or as much as he was a receiver. They made him a receiver, and obviously he turned into the backbone from a playmaker perspective of those teams. And that's all I'm saying is this: maybe everybody, get a little Bobby Bethard in your brain right now as you're going into another offseason. Washington has a lot going on off the field with ownership. And, I think that Ron Rivera's group, they've done okay in some areas, but they've been kind of a bit all over the place when it comes to what's the logic with what they're doing. The Carson Wentz is a good example. Understood sort of the principle for what they were trying to do, but ultimately I didn't understand the target or the execution didn't seem to make a ton of sense. So they could use, I think, some Bobby Bethard in them, shake it up, figure out ways to get creative here. And I would just say keep that in mind as well as you're evaluating what Washington is doing or should do. Just think about Bobby Bethard and how you can go outside the box to find good stuff. Sometimes you'll break some eggs. Sometimes you'll make a great omelet. And we'll go from there. But rest in peace to Bobby Bethard and to his former colleagues and friends and family alike for sure.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it: tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, let's get to it here. Nikki and I spoke at length about a bunch of topics. As I said, we start off with the Senior Bowl, sort of a behind-the-scenes look at what it's like to cover that type of event, how things are different, what that could mean for future NFL off seasons, and then, of course, we get into the nitty-gritty of it all. In fact, let me just give you guys, you'll hear it when you go forward, but here are some of the topics
that we got into, and I want to mention these up front so you can contemplate them in advance a little bit. In no particular order, what is more likely, Daron Payne or Cam Curl signing an extension this offseason? What's more likely, Washington drafts a tight end in the first round or Logan Thomas returns? What's more likely in the Super Bowl this week? Or, sorry, what's more likely, Taylor Heinicke gets mentioned during the Super Bowl as the lone starting quarterback to beat a Jalen Hurts team this year, or he returns to Washington in 2023? We'll get to those types of questions and a bunch more about the offensive line, players to keep an eye on the Senior Bowl, all that stuff. So here we go. Myself, Nikki Javala from the Washington Post, here on the Standard Groom Only podcast. All right, as promised, joining us here on the podcast, he's back from the Senior Bowl. You know, another triumphant visit for her to Mobile, Alabama. Nikki Javala with the Washington Post. Was that the first time? I don't think you've been to Mobile the two times I was there. When was the last time you were there before this year?
It was Josh Allen's year. So
18.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Okay. So what did you think? Has Mobile changed a lot in the 5 years since you were there last?
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, well, when I went there, they were still having games and practices at Ladd People Stadium, and now it's at
South Alabama campus.
Yeah. So that part is different, but also just the general feel of it. It's become more formal, for better or worse. You know, when I went, and as was the case for years prior, it was kind of an open thing. You know, it was reporters, it was players, it was agents, executives, coaches, scouts, and you could pretty much mingle amongst yourselves. And, you know, there would be a scene in the evenings of, you know, going out to bars. I hate to say plural because it was really one at the time in Beats. But it was pretty open, and that was a lot of the draw of the Senior Bowl, is, you know, you could get to know a lot of the prospects that were going to be in the upcoming draft, but you could also spend time with other people that, you know, were important to your reporting, and relationships and kind of building those up throughout the week was an important part. And that's really limited now. I think, it like with anything in the NFL, it's gotten too big for its own good.
So just to sort of set that up. So obviously, if we tell people, hey, we went to the Senior Bowl, the assumption is, oh, okay, cool, you went to watch the players on the field trying to figure out which offensive tackle or cornerback or whatever Washington might draft. And there are definitely people who are doing that. Obviously, our guy Dane Brugler, this is what he's doing. Nick Baumgartner, another one of our draft guys, he and I spoke the other day on the podcast. You can go, if you want to hear all about the prospects, go listen to that one. But a lot of us are going to these things not really to break down the players. It's a networking event, essentially. It's no different than going to a convention hall and everybody's got a booth, except in this case, the topic is football and everybody from the league is there, in theory, and you're trying to catch up with them, whether you're reporters or even if it's like coaches trying to figure out what other jobs are available. So that's really the baseline of what we're talking about here. And before, it was definitely much more like a sleepy town situation. Like, it was really kind of, wait, you're younger than me. If I say Ali Ali Oxen Free, does that mean anything?
I mean, I remember it, but
okay. I threw that out to somebody the other day who's younger than both of us, and they were like, I don't know what that means. I'm like, oh God, okay, I'm gonna go jump off a cliff. I mean, basically, it was just wide open. You could kind of do whatever you want. Here's where the events were being held or whatever, or here's where people would hang out, but you could do whatever. And like you said, now it's become a little bit tighter. And I think that I do think there's a changing of the guard here, perhaps with the Senior Bowl in terms of its importance. And I think this week was an example of that. Did you find, so again, sort of to your point, was it as successful for you as you were kind of hoping it would be, whatever it was that you were trying to accomplish?
Not really.
I'll say for me, it wasn't. I'll be honest.
Yeah. I mean, no, it wasn't. And there were multiple factors at play here. And I hate to ever be like, I don't want to be like the whiny media person because it's access and it's a chance to watch these guys as they're coming up. And there are certainly benefits of it. And at this point, with, you know, layoffs across the board and so many outlets, I'm always grateful that we get to go to these things. But compared to years past, the benefits aren't what they used to be. There are way more restrictions on kind of where you can go in the stadium, which in turn limits who you can talk to. I mean, the media are pretty much, you know, cordoned off from, you know, the executives and coaches and scouts.
The way that it used to be in the original stadium that they'd used forever, everybody was on the same side of the field.
Yeah.
The teams, the media, anybody random. I remember when Kyle Smith was running the front office, he was there. Ran into some random players, even, you know, Rivera when he was there the first year, et cetera. And now when they switch stadiums during the pandemic, it's a better stadium. It wasn't built, I presume, in the 1930s or whatever.
No, I think it was recently built, but like they don't even before you could in the old Lad People Stadium, you'd be able to walk around the entire facility and, you know, talk to whoever you want, sit wherever you want. You know, you could work in the press box. Now the press box isn't even open to media. It's open to, you know, some officials who are helping to run the game and some of their technology partners. And like half the stadium is for the teams, the other half is for media. There's security everywhere. You know they're blocking people off so you can't go, and then when you want to go on the field to talk to players, you get all of 10 minutes. I mean, for me, it takes me 5 minutes to figure out where everybody is, and then by the time you do and finally get somebody, you have like 2 minutes to get in a full interview, so it's not totally helpful. And I get it, they have a schedule they got to keep to, but you know, it does detract from the benefits of it for players and media. You know, this is for players, this is a chance for them to really get their real introduction to, you know, the pre-draft circus. And this is an event that has helped so many players leap, you know, multiple rounds. And when they do that, that's money. That's setting up their future. So this is beneficial to everybody.
Right.
So and this year it wasn't the same. It didn't feel like many teams sent full folks, and that's becoming more of the norm. Not norm, but more and more teams are doing that. Like the Rams, I don't know if Dallas's folks ever made it out there. They had the issues with the ice storm.
Right, but, and obviously people made a big fuss about Rivera not being there, and then turns out he's out in California. And I didn't get that worked up over the fact that he wasn't there, because a lot of teams weren't there. And to that point, again, just to be clear, like, this is not two reporters whining. This is sort of trying to explain like what the event is and how it's evolving, because the way it's worked in the past, like, people want to know, well, what are the Commanders thinking about doing, or is this person going up or down or any of that stuff? Well, in order to do that in a real way, you got to talk to people. Right. And there weren't as many people around to talk to as there were normally. And then on top of it, as we're saying, the team officials are largely kept away from us, penned off. Certain parts of the event in the downtown area that were open before were closed off to not just us, to agents as well. A lot of these agents, let's be honest, they don't want to go. They don't want to be in Mobile, Alabama, from wherever they're coming from for a few days, but they do it because they have clients, and then they don't even have much access to their own clients because of these restrictions. And this is all happening as the East-West Shrine Game out in Vegas is now sort of part of Pro Bowl week, opposite to reimagined Pro Bowl. And there were clearly some people there that would have been normally in Mobile. And the point is, it's interesting to see how this is all going to unfold. And, you know, for the players, like, I know some people say, oh, well, the media doesn't need to talk to anybody. Well, we do. And it benefits everybody. And if we're all not there because if we decide it's not worth it for us, and then they get less exposure, less attention, and it's all a big cycle. So I think we're in a very interesting moment here with these pre-draft situations. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next year.
Right. No, definitely. I mean, there's not competition, especially with the NFLPA Bowl and, you know, other entities having their, you know, end of season all-star games for college prospects. And with more and more, I feel like we're inevitably going to see a lot more players just kind of sit these out. I mean, how many times have there been injuries at these things that derail the start to a player's career and ultimately, you know, maybe the trajectory of their career too. So, you know, there are ultimate benefits for everybody. There are also risks, and when you don't feel like you get the benefits, the full benefits, you know, sometimes that can, you know, turn you off to whatever risks there may be. So it was interesting. It was definitely different. And I think a part of that too is just the class they had in, you know, such a talented draft class. Right. But not all the top players were there, and it always begins and ends with quarterback. You know, had they had, you know, the top quarterbacks in the draft, then I think it would have been a lot different. You know, maybe not the access for us, but the interest certainly. And you know, because there weren't those big name players, then it kind of detracted from it.
Right. This was it's about as unsexy of a group of players in Mobile as you could have. Like, I mean, there will be a couple of players who get picked in the first round, but nobody that's going, wow, that guy is a player. It's like, okay, well, somebody's gonna have to go in the top 32 and they could be good or fine, including some guys that, you know, I would imagine Washington would consider, but at the same point, it was not particularly a dynamic class. I wrote the other day about Luke Musgrave, the tight end from Oregon State, who basically didn't play much of last year because of injury, but he's in the mix to be the number one tight end. And part of the reason I wrote about him, beyond that Washington could use one, is that there weren't a lot of other guys there. So when I wrote about a tight end, I had a lot of my comments were like, hey, what are you doing? Don't give Washington a tight end. I'm like, well, one, I don't necessarily agree. And two, who do you want me to write about?
Right, right. They're just, you know, it's just the nature of this class.
Yeah.
Makes me feel old, though.
Can I tell as an indication? Yeah, I know. Well, did you cover his dad as a coach or not not as a player?
Well, I mean, it's his uncle.
I mean, his uncle. I mean, yeah.
His uncle. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, just when you start to see multiple generations of families, you're like, oh wow, I've been doing this a long time. I'm getting old, but I'm calling him Mini Moose from now on. He doesn't know that, but I'm doing it anyway.
Oh, okay. Well, I look forward to him coming here, and you doing this and.
Yeah.
No. They. All right. Well. Good. Am I allowed to tell? To emphasize though, the how small it is. There's everything says within like a few blocks. Am I allowed to tell the Jack Del Rio, story from out there?
Yeah. Go for it.
Nikki, forgetting that this is an audio scenario, and she's nodding at me. But okay, she did say yes. So as a quick backdrop. So the Commanders, because Rivera was not there, and they didn't make Martin Mayhew available. They did not send anybody down from their PR staff to, you know, sort of direct traffic, so to speak. There was, because they had coaches in the game like Ryan Kerrigan and Jennifer King, there was some notion of, hey, when they're available, keep an eye on our camera guy, basically, or our audio guy. But other than that, you know, you're on your own. And somebody said, hey, well, Del Rio's here. Can we get him? And the response was basically, well, you know, he's a grown adult. You want to get him, you can ask. But, you know, I think we all kind of knew he's not going to talk to us on the record. That was pretty obvious. Anyway, the other component to this is, right, one of the running jokes we all have within the media group is when somebody's, like, taking a call or why were you late or what were you doing, you make some comment about, like, well, you know, I was talking to Dan on the other line. Dan or Tanya or whatever it might be, or maybe it's a Jason or Ron bit, but somebody that we all know you're not actually talking to. And it's like the, you know, the boy that cries wolf kind of thing. We're making all jokes about it. Am I on track so far?
Yes.
So the Tuesday morning was effectively the first day. They had a very early, we had to pick up credentials at like 7 a.m. And then there was like a little press conference after that. And then we had like 2.5 hours or so to kill before the practice. So you, me, and Sam, and your colleague Sam Fortier were the only reporters there. I guess David Harrison from the Locked On Commanders podcast was there. So we decided to go get breakfast like people do. And we walk like 4 or 5 blocks to some random hole in the wall. Like, there are no tables in this place. It's just countertops everywhere. So the three of us are sitting at a countertop facing out the window, eating our breakfast. You have big, important plans. So you walk out to leave. Sam and I are sitting there, and literally within 5 seconds, Jack Del Rio walked into the place. And I, being in, along with a couple other assistants, I, being a nice person, text my colleague and say, hey, by the way, Del Rio just walked in. And you were thinking, of course, bullshit. Get out of here. Ha ha. Super funny. Am I right so far?
You are accurate. Yes, yeah. You are.
And I'm like, no, I'm serious. You're like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'm like, look, I'll bet, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to convince? I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'll swear on Lenny's head. Anybody knows if I'm doing that, it's got to be a real thing. Well, anyway, so not only is Del Rio in the place, he's sitting, like, if I fell backwards in my chair, I would have hit him in the back. But he didn't see us because, you know, why is he thinking? Anyway, 5 minutes later, I don't know if you were out of breath. In my head, I'm going to say you were. 5 minutes later, who comes striding back in? And you're like, oh, my God, you weren't lying to me.
Yeah. No, it was. Yeah, I had to change my plans because it's like there's so few opportunities just to see these people. And like, you never know if they're going to deal with you or whatever. And it's always that weird balance of, all right, I don't want to come off as TMZ-ish and stalking people. But, you know, when there's an opportunity to have a conversation, you want to take advantage of it. And so, yeah, I circled back. On the way back, I rearranged my plans to set up an interview for the later date and then just sat there and then watched them walk out and be like, peace, we're gone. So I was like, cool, that was so worth it.
Yeah, nothing necessarily happened, but just like it being, like, you know, we've all been around like famous people and you're like, oh, look at that. It's not like that, but it is like sort of like seeing, you know, somebody out in the wild. And I mean, we did talk to him briefly, like in a human way, not in a, you know, are you guys keeping Deron Payne kind of a way. But yeah, anyway, that's just how I did it. Like some random place he just walked into that we were in, and that's how it goes. Over there. Did you have any other takeaways from your time at the Senior Bowl? Anything else sort of behind the scenes that you think people would be interested in? I don't mean tell us your what's in your notebook. I mean, you know, feel free. But
not really. I mean, like with any league event, there's always a scene in the evenings, but I've never really enjoyed the scene in the evenings. It's a let's go out at 10 o'clock, if not later, stand around in a bar where nobody can hear each other, drink a lot of bad beer, and wait to see who shows up and if anybody will talk to us. And most of the time, if they do talk to us, they're completely inebriated, and it's, you know, nothing you can use on the record, obviously. So it's just like, So many times I end up going back to my hotel and question my life choices. Like, what just happened? What am I doing? I need to get an adult job at some point.
Yeah,
I've yet to do that. I've like passed that point where I could become qualified for such a thing anyway. So it's like, this is it.
I will say, like, I went out to dinner twice with my colleagues from The Athletic. I didn't pick the restaurant. You know, again, there's not many places to go near the main part of this. Both times I went out at a table where, picture all the national reporters, the national insider types that you're thinking about other than Schefter, and they were all sitting there together at a table, and all I wanted to have happen was Schefter to tweet out some news and watch everybody get frantic about how they had to confirm something. That was my one hope. It did not come true, unfortunately. But yes, they were all out about eating food, just like, you know, they're just like the rest of us.
Yeah. It's a weird scene. It's like it's such a small town, so you always see people walking on the streets, and there's, you know, before there was really only one spot where people would go in the evenings. It's called Veets. It's this little hole in the wall bar. It's kind of grimy and gross, but now there are more spots, and, you know, everybody's just kind of making the rounds to all of them to see who they see. And it's just, it's bizarre.
So there's like three big events in the off season. Typically, like, you'll be going to the Super Bowl, and I'm not counting that. But in terms of like the off season stuff, there's the Senior Bowl, the NFL Combine in Indianapolis, and the owners meeting, which is in general, right, it's either somewhere like West Palm Beach, Florida, like it was last year, or where it is this year out in Arizona near Phoenix. I think I know the answer, but the people may not. Of the rank the three from your perspective as a reporter, like what you're looking to accomplish, or you can look at it from the perspective of where I want to just be for a few days.
Yeah. I mean, I always prefer owners meetings. The Combine has become such a production, and I feel like it's a meat market anyway, especially with the addition of fans watching, you know, watching many of which are teenagers essentially. lift weights and do the bench press and do all these events. To me, it's weird. And it's become such a TV production now. I mean, the whole schedule has been flipped around to be geared toward the production of it. So it's become similar to the Senior Bowl in that, you know, there are so many limitations on what you can do and what you can get and who you can talk to and when you can talk to them and et cetera, et cetera. But I really like the owners' meetings. And for one, it's always at a lavish resort. So you can really go wrong there. And it's much more casual. So, you know, owners, a few coaches that are there, executives, they're in a much more relaxed state. Many bring their families for like a mini vacation. Reporters there, it's open, you know. There's always that fine line. There's always going to be those reporters who, you know, cross that line and don't give these guys the space that's warranted. But the ones that play it right, you know, they're able to get information and build relationships and see a lot of the reporters that you want to see at these league events. So I've always found those incredibly beneficial. And then there's some structured media availability at owners meetings too, with, you know, the breakfasts with, you know, all the coaches. And then you can usually, teams will set up, you know, additional availability with their local media. So I've always found that to be incredibly beneficial. And it usually, I mean, it's stuff that you can collect and it's usable over the course of the entire off season, because there is so few times with availability. So I love owners meetings. It's like a few days. It's the right amount of time. Get a solid tan. They have a good party
too. Well, look, I think a lot of us, you were probably a smart one, but I think a lot of us got a, maybe not a tan, but a bit of a sunburn the first day at the Senior Bowl, because normally the temperature, at least when I've gone, has been dicey. It is winter. And it was like high of 76, big sun. And it was so hilarious that the next day, literally everybody showed up with a sunburned face.
Sam Fortier definitely did. And he was ordered to like put sunscreen on and refused. So I don't feel bad, Sam Fortier. I did as well. Like, I got a solid cutout of the lanyard that holds the credential.
Sure.
Like, I got like this line across like my neck down my chest. And it's like, it's very attractive looking. Let me tell you.
Well, like you said, everybody had something going on. One of my colleagues, only half of his side of his face got sunburned, so that's a whole other level.
Nice. Yeah. You got the Joker look. That's pretty solid.
Yeah, that's pretty good. It's a pretty good look. Yeah. All right, so as I said, we're not going to dive in too much here into the prospects themselves. We're talking, the actual game is happening, I think, right now on TV. But like I said, I did talk about this the other day with Nick Baumgartner, one of our draft analysts, so you can go check out that podcast. But I will do a couple of most likely questions here, this thus allowing us to talk about the draft and as well as the current team. Are you ready? Are you ready to accept this challenge?
Sure.
But I really wish now I had the cameras on. You could see the trepidation in her face when I just asked this.
I have no idea what's going on, but let's do it. Let's go for it. I'm ready.
All right. What is more likely? Now, again, you were just at the Senior Bowl. You're getting into the draft. What is more likely? That Washington drafts a tight end in the first round or Logan Thomas returns? What is more likely?
They draft a tight end in the first round?
I don't have a bell, but I would hit one to say I think that is accurate. Now, maybe that says more about Logan Thomas' situation. But I was getting into it with people about the idea of drafting a tight end in the first round, and a lot of people were saying that's not a wise idea. It's not a good value. You know, tight ends are not the most important positions, things like that. But I would, my counter is basically, one, that's a whole hypothetical. You know, it's just like when people would say, well, you shouldn't draft a guard top 10, and maybe that's fair hypothetically, but it's not like Brandon Scherff wasn't good or Quentin Nelson isn't good. If the individual player makes sense, then you should look at it. And there's like four tight ends in this class that are considered to be like worthy of the first. I mentioned Luke Musgrave. He was the one of the four there. Michael Meyer from Notre Dame is sort of the other name a lot of people have heard of. So I don't really have an issue with it. And if you have a tight end, it's a huge difference. There's only so many of those guys that go around. Wide receivers, you can kind of find a lot of places. So I'm fine if they do, if they ended up doing that. Other people are not. Are you kosher if they actually do? I mean, again, it's all relative to whether the player is worth it. I'm not saying overdraft. Yeah. I'm not saying you have to take one. I'm saying hypothetically, if the player, if the value is there, would you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a huge fan of, you know, using first round money on a tight end. I just don't think the value is there for that position. And yeah, Washington, their tight ends were not terribly productive last season, to put it politely, but they also didn't go to their tight ends. You know, what's the point of having tight ends if you don't use them? And there's no guarantee that that will change. So, you know, that's given their needs, especially up front, that is not the position I would love for them to spend on. Especially given the record of developing a lot of guys who were brand new to the position and turned into pretty good players. Looking back last year, they had a pretty solid group. So I think there's other ways to get talent at that position. I just don't, you know, first round money is a lot of money. I think people forget that. That is a lot of money, and it's a fully guaranteed 4-year contract. So yeah, I would like them to spend elsewhere if they're going to go in the first round. Like, to me, like, offensive line, certainly, which I know is not a sexy pick, but if you look at the teams that are in the Super Bowl this year and are regularly in the Super Bowl, they typically have these homegrown offensive lines that are, you know, monstrous. I mean, look at the Eagles right now. I mean, that line is one of the best of all time, in my opinion. And there's a reason they're winning, and a lot of it is due to that offensive line as well as other positions they're stacked. But it's such an important, that front five is just so important. And I think the good teams realize that and learn to invest in it. And the ones that don't, the ones that think they could get by with cheaper talent, like Washington did this past season, end up paying for it, like Washington did this past season.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't, like, yeah, like, for me, it's not an either or. Obviously, all things being equal, I'm taking the offensive line. But, like, even in terms of this past year, right, when Logan Thomas was in there as the one tight end, his blocking, let's just say, wasn't ideal. You probably had a better sense of what that they were going to throw the ball, or throw the ball. But even if they didn't, and he stayed in the block, it wasn't really going to help your cause. And we know the line struggled. If you don't have a tight end that can kind of do block and pass, it makes it a little bit easier for the defense to probably guess what you're doing. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I think the guys who, and again, maybe none of these draft picks are worthy of, or two-way threats in that difference-making kind of a way. But I do think there is value in that. And also, like, offensive linemen, there's just more of them in theory that you can find that can start. You know, the right isn't the argument everybody says is don't draft the guard in the first round or two. Can I give you this though? I'm looking at the draft for the last few years. Okay, 2018, the last time you famously attended. Here were the tight ends picked in the first couple of rounds: Hayden Hurst, Mike Gesicki, Dallas Goedert. No busts in there. The Dolphins just don't know how to use Gesicki, but all three of those guys have been pretty good.
Yeah. The highest one was taken.
What's that?
What's the highest one of those was taken?
Hurst was a first, but I feel like he was like later in the first.
Yeah.
I moved off of that screen. Hold on 1 second. All right. The following year. Boy, this is great. This is a great podcast. And the following year, TJ Hockenson, 8, Noah Fant, 20, Irv Smith, 50, and then Drew Sample. I don't know that he's done that much. Hockenson's obviously pretty good, but and Fant, yeah, or Smith, are they're fine.
And Fant has framed a lot of my thinking on this, and I didn't want to say it because I didn't want to be, oh my God, she's talking about Denver again. But like, it made no sense for them to take a tight end there, and they did it anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, you know,
and
like,
the player just didn't turn out. It's no disrespect to Noah Fant. It's just it's so challenging for a player at that position to live up to that draft billing. Because the player is so reliant on the quarterback play.
100%. I mean, but at least to a degree, right? He is a viable player. Like, I'm not saying everything is equates to fantasy football, but like, he was a guy you could use this year
Sure. Fantasy, if you, you didn't to. Need to draft him in, at that spot in the first round.
Oh, no, no, for sure.
Kyle Pitts is one where I was like, yeah, he absolutely deserves to be a top five pick. You know, I mean, the only ones over the last year, I'm looking at it now.
Cole Kmet in 2020, not amazing, but he was the only tight end picked in the first two rounds, and he's been pretty good. I feel free to fire off whatever names have come up the last 2 years, but and obviously 2022 we'll just have to wait and see to a degree. But I'm just saying, like, by and large, there's not a ton of them that are getting picked, talks to scarcity, and two, they at least are viable players. It's sort of like Jamin Davis, at least this year, looks like he'll be a viable player. Will he ultimately have been worth the 19th pick? Well, we'll see, but that's you can't always predict that, but can they at least play?
But that's not what you're looking for with the first round pick. You're looking for an immediate starter who is a value add in every respect. I mean, over the last, since the turn of the century, since 2000, sorry, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 tight ends have been taken above 16 or higher in the draft. Kyle Pitts, yes. Kellen Winslow, Vernon Davis, obviously. Hockenson, Eric Ebron, Bubba Franks, Jeremy Shockey. Like, there's a reason that you got to be like a freaking unicorn to be a tight end taken that high. And rightfully so. I mean, the problem is that the free agent market for tight ends has just become so insane. I mean, it's just, so you got to, like, in my opinion, that's a position you take on day two, and you really hope you can develop a kid. Like, you had that incredible stat about Cole Turner. Please share that.
Was that the stat that Cole Turner had finished year with two catches, which meant he had one less touch than Reggie Bonifon did this year, who was only signed to the active roster in the last game?
Yes, that is the one.
Right. Well, and so that is sort of the chicken and the egg of this whole tight end thing. It's, again, I'm not advocating picking somebody in the first round. I am advocating, though, you've got to find a way to maximize that position. Like, hypothetically, if you turned Curtis Samuel into a tight end equivalent and then had to use De'Ami Brown or Cam Sims more, I think they'd be fine. But last year, they didn't get anything out of the tight end group. They were 28th in catches. Now, they may look at it, and I think they might, that Armani Rogers and Cole Turner, there's two lottery tickets there. Both of them, I think, actually held up pretty well as blockers last year, but they just didn't get thrown the ball a ton for a variety of reasons. If they think one of those guys can develop, cool, then don't draft one. But I'm just saying, I don't have an issue if they actually decided, whether it's Musgrave or Michael Meyer or one of these other guys that are up there, that they think, hey, they can do it. I won't have an issue with it. Again, they have to get offensive lineman and cornerback somewhere. But just saying, I won't freak out. Okay, but to the other point of this question that I asked you an hour ago, Logan Thomas, I think we're both kind of thinking, doesn't feel like he's going to be back. One, wasn't terribly productive last year. Two, he's, you know, getting up there in age. And three, you know, the salary cap situation. You can get some cap savings on that. Let me do you have that handy? If not, I've got it here somewhere.
Yeah, pull it up.
So he's got a cap hit of $8.6 million, dead cap $3 million. So you would save a little over $5 million by moving on from him. And, you know, does John Bates, Cole Turner, Monty Rogers, and mystery tight end do enough for me? Well, maybe, but at least there's some upside there. There's youth. And it kind of feels like to me that would be a guy who could be gone. And that, to me, that's almost more of the point of the question than whether you would draft one at 16.
Yeah. No, I mean, he looked really promising in 2020. And this is no fault to him, but he hasn't been able to stay healthy. Hasn't been able to stay on the field consistently, and that's hurt a lot of it. The rotation of quarterbacks, again, does not help the tight ends. It doesn't help anybody. But that's also part of it. He's going to be, 32? Or is he already 32? He'll be 32. He's 31 currently. A lot of competing factors there. But he was very good for that room, and had he had, back-to-back productive seasons, I think it would have been a different story, but he's got no guaranteed money left on his deal, so it's kind of an easy out for the team at this point.
Right. I mean, you could always obviously renegotiate a deal, lower the cap hit this year, add on another year, but, I don't know. look, the coming up right off the ACL is can be tough, and sometimes it is the next year when the player looks closer to their form. That's going to be a question they're going to have to get. It's been, 2020 was really good. Since then, injuries and other factors have just, it hasn't looked the same.
Yeah, no, I agree.
All right. I don't know if you're aware of this. Offensive coordinator, they're still looking for one.
What?
I know.
Seriously?
I know. Wow.
The whole process has been kind of weird. Here's it. The thing is, and I think this is reasonable to believe from the outside, and I'm sure they're aware of it, obviously, but, the uncertainty with the ownership situation plays into it quite a bit. This could be viewed from the outside as sort of a lame duck position. So you're not going to get, some of the top candidates whose names are circulating around for other jobs. This is, if they view this as sort of a one-year rental type job, if they have options, Washington's probably going to be at the bottom of them. So, and a lot of people they've interviewed their names haven't come up as ones that have had a ton of options. The one who has is Eric Bieniemy, and that's seemingly what the holdup is at this point, since he's in the Super Bowl, and they can't talk to him until after. But, it's they're in kind of a weird place. And I think a lot of the people who have interviewed are kind of like, what's going on here?
Right. Well, the Bieniemy thing is weird in the sense that, I just saw, I saw that the Eagles offensive coordinator is interviewing a second time with somebody. Right. Also in the game. And yet for Bieniemy, it's they're waiting, and it's going to wait until after the Super Bowl. And also they don't seem, I'm not saying they're not doing stuff, but they don't seem that pressed. They haven't even had a second interview, as far as we know, with anybody. The Ravens, who were a week behind because they were actually in the playoffs, they've already interviewed some people multiple times. They're also supposedly in the Bieniemy market. But anyway, here's the question, ultimately. More likely, offensive coordinator, Ken Zampezi, the in-house guy, he's the quarterback coach, has been interviewed, or the field, meaning anybody else outside. The obvious thing would be, there's more people on the outside to take them, but Zampezi's there. He worked with Sam Howell already. And as we're talking about options, I don't know. Who knows who would be willing to ultimately accept this? So Ken Zampezi versus the field, who outside the building, what would you take?
I could totally see it being Zampezi. Again, given the ownership uncertainty, go with a familiar name, the guy that knows the system, knows the quarterbacks. I could totally see him doing that. I also wouldn't be surprised if they go the Pat Shurmur route. Would not be my first choice, but it is not my team to run. So, we know Ron liked him in 2013, tried to hire him then with the Panthers. I could totally see them going down that route. None of these options really move the needle, let's be honest.
The ones that you could get a little more excited about are the guys who have never done it before. The Charles Londons, Eric Studsville, Thomas Brown.
I think any of those could be really interesting. I think Anthony Lynn, is honestly a good candidate. He's run his team before, well-liked by players, a good coach. To me, he would be really intriguing. Why he would want to leave his set up with San Fran, a very good team, for this, I don't know, unless he views it as a launching pad to get back into head coaching. I don't know. And I think, I think the holdup with Bieniemy is this is a preference of Bieniemy, not so much the team. Bieniemy is trying to see about the Colts job. So again, this is, Washington is clearly not a first choice for him.
Spoiler, I don't think he's getting the Colts job.
Right. But,
the Colts meaning Ravens, a head coaching job.
Maybe 3-4 on the list,
Right. So. Yeah. I would probably, in the hypothetical I just gave, I would probably say Zampezi as well, because it's the sort of the safest route, and it feels like that's ultimately kind of where they're going to where they're headed. All right, I got a semi silly one for you.
Okay.
Super Bowl is coming up. You'll be at the game, but I knowing you, you'll probably find a way to listen to the game as well, as opposed to just watching it. So in terms of the broadcast, Taylor Heinicke, is it more likely that he is mentioned by name during the Super Bowl as the only starting quarterback this year to beat a Jalen Hurts Eagles team, or he returns to Washington in 2023?
Mentioned.
So is that your way of saying, Taylor, it's been a good ride. We enjoyed the t-shirts and the shoe buying and the diving and all that, but you're playing somewhere else next year.
Well, I think it's the team would like him back. I think it's a question of whether he would want to be back. And don't get this twisted, but he helped them to the playoffs and then they ultimately benched him when it mattered most. So if you're a player in that position, how would you feel about and I don't want to speak for him. I haven't talked to him about this, but that's kind of that would be my thinking. And he's got a winning record as a quarterback. So he should have options, be it as a backup or someone competing for a starting job. Where, I don't know exactly, but I could totally see him wanting to test the waters and see what's available to him before, fully committing here. He said he likes it here, loves the players, obviously familiar with the staff. So I would think he would want to kind of explore his options on the open market. But I mean, yeah. It would, to me, if I were a coach, it would totally make sense to bring him back because he's well-liked. He's great in the locker room. He's, if he's going to be the backup to Sam Howell, that he's going to do whatever he can to help the kid. He can step in and win a game. He's everything you want in a backup quarterback. But it may be a preference of his to see what else is out there and see, if he can get a bigger role elsewhere.
Yeah, I would just say that to me would come down to, do they really, 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 really believe that Sam Howell's starting for them? I'd still maintain that whole spiel, what they're telling the coordinators, is as much to change the narrative around here so we stop talking about Carson Wentz and start talking about the future and Sam Howell's interesting. So I don't know if I'm still buying.
Well, it's more he's the only one under contract for next season. of course he's going to be for right now he's the starter because he's the only one that will be under contract as of March 7th or whatever.
Well, like last year, Heinicke was still under contract and they were making it pretty clear they were bringing in anybody else but him. And I'm saying if they don't view Taylor as a potential starter, which I think clearly they don't, then you're really saying we're buying Sam Howell is getting us through this. And, they don't want to have to rely on Heinicke other than injury or whoever that would be.
Right.
All right. Another more likely one for you. Starting right tackle week one, Sam Cosmi or a tackle they picked in the first round?
I don't know about first round. I would just say tackle not currently on the roster.
Yeah, I think they're moving him to guard.
Yeah, I think so too.
Are you accepting of that? Because I don't think he is. I don't think he is, but
he may not have a choice.
True. True. He may not have a choice. I've been coming up with these that brain of yours, I'm sure, is coming up with something. Do you have your own version of this kind of a question, even if it isn't necessarily directly about the Commanders?
Will Cole Holcomb be on this team, yes or no?
I'm going to say yes, but on a one-year deal or something.
Okay. I could see that. Just given their dearth of linebackers.
And also, I don't know what, he obviously missed, basically half the year because of the injury, so I don't know what his market will be.
Right.
And then maybe be able to give him enough to make it worthwhile for 1 year and then everybody reassesses where they are after the year.
Yeah. How old is he? I should know this. Looking it up.
I mean, 26?
He's young. Yeah, he's young. Yeah, so 27. Yeah, he'd still be young enough to.
More likely to sign an extension, Daron Payne or Cam Curl?
Cam Curl.
Because you think they recognize that he's really valuable, even if the head coach doesn't want us mentioning that publicly, or because Daron Payne, for all the reasons we've all discussed for months, is not likely back?
Both. C, all of the above. I mean, I Cam Curl is incredibly important to the defense because of all that he does. And that's not to say that Daron Payne isn't. I think he's very, very important. I think the interior of that defensive line is the crux of the defensive line. If there's one player I would say is not worth keeping, it would be Chase Young. Hot take. But I don't foresee that happening since they picked him at number two overall. And there's only so much money you can allocate to one positional group. So are you going to pay all four of them? If you're keeping Duran, you're not keeping Montez. Montez, I think, is this, you know, incredibly valuable. I think he's their best defensive end, no doubt. So, you know, it becomes a numbers issue. But also, does Daron Payne want to stay here? He will have options. I mean, he will get paid some way, somehow. This season, it could be on the tag. And then he's up again next year. He's young enough to where he can make a good chunk of change, no matter the circumstances. If I were him, obviously, and this is probably the case for any player, they would rather get, you know, a longer-term deal now, since they just played the best season of their life, get the security, and then move forward. But, you know, he's young enough to where he could get a tag and then still get a long-term deal if he has a decent season.
She is Nikki Javala with the Washington Post, always a person up for the franchise tag because of her value in the open market. So, you know, you got to... Got to figure out how to lock her in.
I hate the tag. I hate the tag. I think it's the dumbest rule ever. It's the Elway rule. I think it's the dumbest thing ever. It doesn't really help teams keep their own guys. It helps teams piss off their own guys for a year, end up spending way too much money because they're guaranteed as soon as you sign them.
When's the last time that anybody used a transition tag? That is still a thing.
That's a great question. I don't remember the
last time. I don't know why that's not like a thing anymore.
What would be the value of the transition tag this year for Daron? It's like a few million less, right?
Right. I mean, I don't think, yeah. I don't think it so much works for him in general, but just the idea of like it never really works. I'll say Cam Curl as well, just because it's just harder to see how they're going to keep Daron. But I can see the tag. Like the tag is not an extension. I'm not counting that. Like an actual, you know, multi-year extension.
Right. Yeah.
All right, I gotta release you back into the wild, at Nikki Javala on Twitter. Anything else that people need to know about your whereabouts, your stories, your hopes, your dreams, anything else you'd like to share with the people?
I'm really hoping for a long walk with the dogs this afternoon, but it could be too cold. My whereabouts, I'll be in Phoenix next week, as you mentioned, for the Super Bowl.
If people see
you, hoping for warm weather there too, that would be great.
If people see you out and about, do you prefer that they just sort of keep their distance, or are you okay with like, hey,
I mean, that's a personal risk that they have to assess, you know, do they want to mingle with me or stay far away? No, come say hi. It'll be great. We'll party in Phoenix. It'll be awesome.
I don't believe anything she just said, but she said it.
mainly the party part, because I'm like old.
right. Mostly that. Always appreciate it, Nikki. Appreciate the time, and good luck in Phoenix.
Thanks. This was fun.